Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Edge of Sports Podcast. I'm Dave Zirin. This week we are talking to Dr. Cheryl Cookie. She is a professor at Purdue University who studies the intersections of sport, gender, culture, and media. But we're talking about her because she wrote a column this week that went completely viral and earned her a tidal wave of hate and vitriol from the fascistic right wing on questions of transgender athletes. She wrote a piece called Leah Thomas's NCAA Championship Performance Gives Women's Sports a Crucial Opportunity. And she writes, anyone who cares about the advancement of sports and women's sports in particular should celebrate her win. I'm so glad Cheryl Cookie's going to talk to us about her column and the uproar it caused and give her the chance to speak about what she's been through the last week, because it's been something else, no joke. Also, I've got some choice words about why I believe the tactical silence around Brittany Griner is just not working. I've also got Just Stand Up and Just Sit Your Ass Down awards. I've also got Kaepernick Watch and more. But first, let's talk to Cheryl Cookie. So, Professor Cookie, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Doing very nicely. For on this lovely Saturday, first I just wanted to ask you, just to start, how did this column come about? I mean, why did you feel the imperative to write something, and how did you make the connection with NBC News? Like, how did this come to be?
Yeah, so I had an editor at NBC Think reach out to me a few weeks ago and ask if I'd be interested. They were looking for someone to write on, you know, sort of gender, sport, culture, and those intersections. And this was sort of in the lead up to the Super Bowl. So I wrote a piece about NFL cheerleaders and the incredible, you know, low wages, hostile work environment they face, sexual harassment, and so on. And so kind of just developed a relationship with NBC Think there and kind of pitched a couple other stories. This particular piece, though, I was interested in writing in part because my colleague and I, Dunya Antunovich, who's at the University of Minnesota, she and I just published a book. And if I may do a sort of shameless plug here, the title of the book is called Serving Equality, Feminism, Media, and Women's Sports. And, you know, some of the things that we've been thinking about are sort of like the ways in which we celebrate firsts in our society and the kind of cultural and media narratives and network narratives that sort of come about when we talk about firsts. And, you know, reading the headlines and hearing about Leah Thomas as the first trans woman to win a D1 NCAA championship, I was just struck by the fact that it seemed that there was so little conversation around her, you know, as a first, right? The kind of celebratory narratives that we might see, typically see in some of the media coverage. And so I pitched the idea and it tracked. And so I wrote the piece. And I think the other kind of dimension of all this as well, Dave, is that, you know, I, kind of as a scholar, I've just been really interested in questions around equality in women's sports. I've advocated for equality in women's sports. I've been sort of grappling with this idea of, you know, how do we sort of reconcile as a society the fact that sports are sex segregated, yet we have these calls to equality, right? And so in my mind, those are kind of two sort of competing ideas or positions that are in tension with one another. And how do we reconcile those? And I saw a lot of those kind of questions coming about as I was thinking through this particular cultural moment.
Wow. So you wrote this column, professor, and it's an argument that I think is really important. It's an argument that's not out there, and hasn't been out there, in certainly not the mainstream media, and even on the blogosphere, or anything like that. Like this idea that Leah Thomas is good for sports, that we should challenge ideas about sex segregation and what it means, and even just have a discussion about what it means. And that Leah Thomas, this is a moment that should be celebrated, and instead it's one, you know, just wrapped in controversy and attacks. It was a bold column. I thought it was terrific. But I'm curious about what the response has been for you broadly. Give us negative and positive. Like, what's it been like for you since the column dropped?
Yeah, it's been quite a roller coaster, I will say. When I was writing the piece, my spouse was like, "Oh, you're going to get some email." And you know, I've done some interviews and kind of been in the public conversations around sport and gender, and you know, every now and then you get an email here or there, and so that's sort of what I was anticipating. I think there was a kind of maybe naivete on my part in terms of the response, and the kind of vitriolic, hateful responses that I received. I think in large part because of the topic, but also I think in terms of the way that the conversation got taken up by some pretty conservative or right-leaning media organizations. And so I was receiving, I think I've gotten within the first week of it being published, about 300 emails. Maybe I think two or three of those were positive. The rest were negative, and it not just like, "I disagree with your ideas," or, you know, "your arguments, have you considered this particular perspective," but just blatantly, you know, kind of, making accusations that I'm mentally ill, that I am, you know, messages using the R word, and I'm not referring to the Washington franchise, but the other R word, you know, claims that I are calls for me to be fired from Purdue. I don't know science. I'm not a feminist. All kinds. I mean, I could go on and on. I don't want to necessarily give, you know, amplify those voices of hate. You know, social media, I'm not really very active on social media to begin with, but I see that as part of my job. And so certainly I think in response to, or sort of my reaction to some of the emails that I was receiving, is if this is what people are sending me on email, I can't even imagine what's happening on social media. But you know, like the curiosity killed the cat, I took a quick peek every now and then, and I'm like, okay, it's not much better there. So, you know, if there are positive conversations that are happening, I'm sure they're happening. People are more likely to speak out when they're angry, or, you know, they have a sort of bone to pick with you, as opposed to saying like, "Yeah, great job," right? We customer service, right? You only hear from the customers that aren't satisfied, so to speak. So it was mostly negative, mostly hate filled. And, you know, I want to just say here too, Dave, and I think this is really important for your listeners to hear and for me to say, is, you know, I want to be clear about my kind of identities and social location. I am a white cisgender woman, and you know, occupying a number of different spaces of privilege, you know, as a university professor and so on. And if I received that kind of hate for just saying something as simple as "we should celebrate an accomplishment in sport," right? Because that's really at the end of the day what we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. And that I'm, you know, raising some questions about, you know, can we have equality in a sex segregated social and cultural institution, right? If that kind of hate is directed toward me, what are the lived experiences of trans people in this culture? What kind of, you know, transphobia, other forms of discrimination, hate, What is it like for them to sort of move through the world, right? And so I think that's really important for us to really think about in this conversation is sort of what does it mean to center the experiences of trans athletes? I don't claim to know those experiences. I'm not suggesting that somehow what I experienced is anything like that, but I think it does provide a window into some really important considerations that we should have in mind when we're moving forward on this issue. And I think unfortunately, the mainstream discourse has centered the experiences of cisgendered athletes in ways that have really distorted the conversation and also rendered invisible the lived experience and the challenges and the very realities of being a trans athlete in this space.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I think you're totally right to say that it sheds light or a window on what it must like to be trans. I would put even a further point on that to say it gives a window about what it's like to be trans right now at this moment in 2022, when there is clearly a very well-funded effort that they want to take to all 50 states to erase trans people. And this is the cause du jour of the right wing. And so like writing this, that's why I thought when you're writing that column, you really, to your credit, put your chin out because, you know, this isn't even 2021 or 2020. Like this particular moment is particularly perilous, as we've talked about on this podcast.
Yeah, Dave, and I think that's a great point too, that, you know, what's happening on a state level with some of the anti-trans bills, and I don't claim to be necessarily an expert in this space, but I think what it's the article and the response and sort of the broader conversations that we're having, right, that while we're talking about policies and eligibility criteria for either, you know, Olympic athletes or collegiate athletes, right, these are kind of the elite sports that get a lot of the media attention, right, and so the focus is often on those athletes or those policies or, you know, those issues. But certainly that trickles down to the high school level, the youth level, right? And so this, you know, while the story itself was about, you know, one athlete, I think it really can shed light into, you know, these sort of larger challenges as you're pointing to, and this kind of moment where, conservatives have kind of latched onto, this issue of trans inclusion in sports as a kind of cultural wedge issue, which I think is unfortunate. And I believe there might be a political scientist. I'm trying to get in contact with them. I have some connections, but I think there's a political scientist that's doing some research. Because one of the things that I'm really curious about, Dave, is, you know, how many of these legislatures or politicians are really concerned with women's sports? Are they concerned about the actual issues that are facing women athletes today? If we're going to talk about threats to women's sports, we should be talking about the lack of funding, the lack of access and opportunities. We should be talking about the lack of resources, the disparities in terms of media attention and focus. We should be talking about the lack of women in decision-making and leadership positions within sports organizations. Those are the issues that we should be focused on, right? And so unless your politics align with a kind of broader equality for women in sports, I personally take issue and question your motivations, right? And I think this, you know, I'm not saying anything that's like mind-blowing here, right? But I think that's a really important point here. Like what is really at stake and what is really the concern, and how is this this issue that affects real people's lives getting mobilized in a way to just advance a particular kind of political agenda? And that to me, I think, is just really unfortunate.
Now, Professor, one of the things that we've been talking about on this show is this I would call it like a tragic alliance between several very notable cisgender women in sports and the really fascistic anti-trans right wing as they block together to keep trans women out of sports. And a lot of these cisgender women, they describe themselves as liberal politically. They say that they're for trans rights in every sphere except for sports. And yet they're blocking with people who are clearly not going to be satisfied with sports as their only hill when it comes to trans erasure. And that's the greatest tragedy of all, is that they're facilitating something that's, I think, truly, truly mind-blowingly evil. Was any of the response you got from any of those women, or was it exclusively from the hard right?
Yeah, you know, I think the responses were coming from all across, I think, the sort of demographic makeup, right? So this wasn't just, I didn't get the sense that this was just kind of the fringe of a particular political party or movement. I think there were certainly a number of people who were emailing, who were saying that, you know, they were very concerned about the future of women's sports. And many of them were, accusing me of, or at least the piece, but it can't, you know, I think the unfortunate thing is that this became about a personal attack on me, as opposed to like talking about the ideas and the questions that I was raising in the piece. But, you know, I was being accused of, you know, the downfall, like when women's sports are no longer, a thing, a viable thing in our society, it will be my fault. And so I think there are people, Dave, who were concerned, that their responses were coming from, I want to believe, maybe an authentic concern for the future of women's sports. I received a number of emails from people who claimed to either have been an athlete, had, you know, daughters or children who played sports, they themselves had played sports, or their partner or spouse had played sports. And, you know, so there was a lot of questions around the science. There was a lot of people just really invested in the notion of biological difference and the kind of, idea that somehow women are physically inferior to men, which is a question that I really wanted us to grapple with and think about, right? What does it mean to advocate for equality when, in order to do so, you have to also assert women's physical inferiority categorically relative to men, which has been a justification and legitimation for the exclusion and unfair treatment of women historically in the sports world, right? So it is unfortunate, I think, that those kind of interests have aligned in this space, the kind of women's sports advocacy of some of those individuals. I have not heard from them personally, but I will say I do think that the kind of that aspect of the women's advocacy space is not the only voice, that there are women's sports advocates who do support trans inclusion in sport. I include myself in that group. So they don't have the monopoly on the conversation and the discourse and the position. And I do believe that those individuals, who are women that I admire, women that I've worked with, whose work I've read and has influenced my thinking on these issues, I believe that they're coming from a space of concern about women's sports. I do question the motivations of the kind of the political dimension of this in terms of politicians and others sort of getting on that bandwagon.
Now, one of the things that the right wing latched on, and I want to give you a chance to respond to this, is that they said that you were comparing Leah Thomas to Jackie Robinson. Now, first of all, as if they give a crap about Jackie Robinson, that's a newfound appreciation that they're having for the history and struggles of a Jackie Robinson. But I thought it was also an incredible distortion of what you were saying. And I just want to give you the chance to speak about the Leah Thomas, Jackie Robinson part of this story.
Yeah, so I was, I was looking at, Leah Thomas as the first trans woman to win a D1 NCAA championship. And again, thinking about all the other firsts that we celebrate in sport, You know, this is an 800 word essay, right? So I can't go through and name all the firsts, right? But we have a way of somehow marking those that they become significant in some way, whether it's the first woman to call a Major League Baseball game, the first athlete, openly gay athlete, I think I mentioned in the piece, the first openly gay athlete, Jason Collins, to play in the NBA, the first woman to score in a Power Five conference football game, Sarah Fuller, right? And so I was situating Thomas within this kind of broader sociocultural historical narrative, right? That we often at the time, right, as a society may be resistant to embracing those firsts, right? Or there might be at least a segment of our culture that is that there's a kind of a push back or a backlash to those individuals. But throughout kind of history and social change, right, we often then come to understand the significance and the meaning of those athletes for broader social justice, civil rights, women's rights kinds of struggles, right? And I think the piece also sort of talks about, I cite Howard Bryant's piece on kind of the way in which the history of Jackie Robinson is really complicated and in ways that we don't, that don't get captured in the kind of sanitized versions that oftentimes, you know, circulate in mainstream discourse. And so it was really about getting us to think about how we celebrate firsts, the kind of what firsts in sport come to mean. They're oftentimes those that are pushing against the status quo. They're breaking through barriers, and eventually we come to embrace those athletes as being the kind of trailblazers of their time. And I was just trying to get people to think about this particular moment, as you mentioned, right? It's 2022. You know, 40, 50 years from now, how are we going to look back on this moment, and what is going to be the cultural significance of Thomas's win for the kind of broader struggles for trans rights and trans inclusion in our society?
Mm. The other thing that you said that really poked the hornet's nest, and we've talked about this, but I want to give you the chance to speak about it, is you said quite explicitly, you know, that Leah Thomas and trans women athletes are good for women's sports.
Yeah.
And what do you mean by that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I believe that if we are going to have equality and we're going to have inclusion, we have to have equality for all, and we have to include all. I am struggling as, again, somebody who advocates for women's equality in sports. I just have a really hard time wrapping my head around how can we advocate for women's sports when we are going to say some women can't compete or some women aren't allowed to compete. And so for me, it's that sort of age-old question, right? Or age-old sort of, word I'm looking for? Cliche saying motto, right? That none of us can be free until we're all free, right? And so I think it's good for women's sports because it starts a conversation around these larger questions with respect to equality. How do we sustain equality in a social institution that's sex segregated? What does it mean? Who gets counted as a woman? And I think that particularly in this instance, what also became apparent to me is that the majority of people, at least the responses that I were receiving, do not see trans women as women.
Exactly.
Right? The narrative of biological difference relies on situating trans athletes within the kind of sex gender binary that they don't identify with or fit into, right? And so I because of the role that sports plays in our culture, in terms of often being a kind of place where social progress and social change can happen, I see this as a really important moment. So I think it's both good for women's sports, and I also think it's good for, you know, sort of thinking about these sort of broader questions around social justice and social equality more broadly.
Mm. Now, why do you think there haven't been more voices defending Leah Thomas? I mean, I think one of the reasons why you were attacked the way you were is because, you know, the column is so singular. Like, if there had been, you know, like if newspapers across the country were saying, let's look at this in a different way, and this is a right-wing assault on one of the most vulnerable populations in our society, I think the fallout to you would have been a lot less. Well, why haven't there been more voices in your mind, particularly among people who consider themselves allies?
Yeah, I'll say this. I think there are voices out there. I think they're just being spoken in kind of spaces that might be adjacent to the mainstream. So I just want to acknowledge that. I think though, if we're talking about sort of mainstream media, right, or kind of like dominant media spaces, you know, certainly I would agree that I think there are very few voices that are speaking out, and in part, I think that's maybe why I wanted to write the piece. I'm not quite sure if I knew that at the time, but I felt like this was an important part of the conversation that needed to be included. And I myself am very frustrated with the way in which, you know, a certain kind of narrative and the sort of conservative voice and the conservative perspective on this issue has really dominated the conversation. And you know, for all the trolls out there, you know, who thought that harassing me online was going to get me to shut up, you know, I hate to break it to you. I'm here. I'm speaking. I am going to keep speaking out on this issue. You know, haters gonna hate, and you know, you can have your perspective, and I'll have mine. And if my perspective causes you to lash out, you know, there's really nothing that I can do about that. I don't know, Dave, how much of that. The kind of backlash, the online harassment, the calls for me to be fired. To me, I read that as a signal, right? That if you're gonna speak out in favor for trans athletes, this is how you are going to be received. This is how you're going to be treated. And I think it's strategic, and I think it's intentional, the distortion of the message to begin with. So we're not actually talking about the real issue. But then also the personal attack on me was also strategic and intentional, because it sends a very loud and powerful message to those who might want to speak out. You know, you might want to think twice about it, because we're going to come after you as well. And that's really unfortunate. I think it's dangerous. I'm not quite sure how we live in an American democracy where only one perspective can be seen as patriotic or American. I mean, that was a piece of this puzzle as well. I was, you know, kind of, I was a communist Marxist, which I'm like, how am I a communist? Like, what does this have to do with Marxism? I'm really confused, or communism for that matter.
Well, they'll figure it out.
They'll figure it out. Somebody can figure it out. Yeah. Right. So, you know, I think, Dave, I forgot what your question was now.
Oh, that's okay. No. It's actually connects with the next question I was going to ask, so it works perfectly.
Sure, go.
We're one of the few places that you've spoken to about the column. And I know when we were talking back and forth, one of the things that you were really wrestling with was about whether further appearances to discuss it could do more harm than good. And I guess I wanted to ask you where your head is around that, and what counsel do you have for cisgender people who want to stand with trans people without doing harm?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I did really struggle with this, and I've been very, mindful and intentional about, you know, when and where and how I speak on this particular issue. and felt like this was going to be a good space to have that conversation, because I trust that the show and you as a journalist are going to do it give it the justice that it deserves. You know, at the end of the day, I kind of came to it's not a satisfactory realization, but I just sort of came to the place that, you know, that I can't control how other people are going to react. And I do hope that the conversation helps to clarify. Maybe there's people out there who were, you know, I think I'm in favor of this, but everyone in my social media feed is, you know, saying X, Y, and Z about this topic and about this person. And I don't know how I feel. I'm kind of hoping that the conversation might help those people better clarify and maybe come to a space where they're like, oh, okay. And it might embolden them or empower them to, you know, speak out on these issues and topics in the spaces and places that they can. And it can be just as easy as having a conversation with a family member or a friend. You know, I've been in contact with advocacy organizations on this. I've been in contact with scholars who do this work. I will admit, you know, there's a way that kind of online harassment and cyberbullying really can be isolating. And I think it's a form of gaslighting, honestly, because I started thinking that I was crazy, right? People were telling me that I was mentally ill, right? But I was like, wait, so did I miss something? You know, am I off the mark here? Am I like all these horrible things that people are saying about me? Am I these things, right? Did I not do this the right way? And so I started, you know, kind of hearing from folks that were like, no, you know, what you said is you know, we support it. This is an important voice. It's an important perspective that needs to get out there. But it really is a kind of, you know, mind fuck, if I can say that, so to speak.
Yeah.
Because you do sort of lose sight of, you know, your kind of moral and ethical and even academic compass in some ways. So I think, you know, being able to have those conversations has been really important and helpful for me as a counterpoint. You know, I think in terms of what people can do and how you can speak out, again, I think knowing your lane and staying in your lane is really important. So I think there's oftentimes a desire for folks to help. And we want to be allies and we want to be advocates. But just knowing that you have to do so in a way that is aligned with what you can contribute. So maybe not stepping too far out of what your lane is. And then also just making sure that when you're doing, you know, that work, that you are in conversation with or in partnership with, you know, the groups that you're sort of trying to collaborate with. And making sure that, you know, allyship is kind of, it's important. It's also problematic in some ways, but I think we do need to have more people speaking out about on this issue. I feel that there is a kind of privilege that I have as a cisgender woman to talk about this issue because my voice might be seen in a different type of way or heard in a different type of way as, unfortunately, and this is not a good thing, right? But, you know, somehow I'm more legitimate because I don't have a personal tie to this topic, right? So I do think that there's, you know, kind of ways that we have to, you know, both acknowledge our own social locations and social privileges, also acknowledging what we know and what we don't know, and acknowledging, you know, the extent to which we can, in the spaces that we work and live in, you know, try to center those experiences so that the, you know, again, the conversation is not so one-sided, if that makes sense.
No, it totally does. So I fear I have to ask you, because I ask this to everybody who comes on the show, and you've been super generous with your time. Thank you so much. But any music has given you some relief during this time? You've been listening to anything?
Oh gosh. You know, honestly, and this is going to sound so basic, Dave, but I have to say it. And I know she herself is somewhat problematic as well, but I'm a fan. I couldn't help gravitating towards Taylor Swift. And the Shake It Off, her Shake It Off song, and the line, you know, haters gonna hate, hate, hate. And I just, I found that helpful. And I know it sounds silly. I swear to God, I'm not a 16-year-old girl, although I think I'm a, you know, 50-year-old woman trapped in the body of a 16-year-old girl or something, or whatever the cliche is. You know, I found that really helpful. Music is always really great in terms of distraction as well. I've been watching Bridgerton. So I've been sort of diving into the Bridgerton season 2 soundtrack, which is also, I think, very bizarre. But, you know, usually I think I tend to gravitate toward, you know, maybe like angry music when I'm in these sort of spaces and moments. But I've just found that kind of maybe more lighter cotton candy fare has been helpful too, just to sort of provide me with a perspective that, you know, things aren't so bad and we just got to shake it off.
No, they're really not, especially when you're helping expand the discussion with forward facing columns like this. Hey, Professor Cookie, thank you so much for appearing on the podcast. This was terrific.
Thanks, Dave, for having me. It's always a pleasure.
We'll be back right after a quick word from the sponsor of this podcast, The Nation Magazine. We'll be back right after this, but first, a quick word from the sponsor of this podcast, The Nation Magazine. Okay, look, the need for independent journalism has never been more important, and The Nation brings it each and every week like they've been doing since 1865. I'm serious. This is what you gotta read. It's The Nation Magazine. Go to thenation.com/subscribe. And please never forget that when you support The Nation Magazine, you are also supporting the continued existence of this podcast. So please subscribe. Go to www.thenation.com/subscribe. And now back to the Edge of Sports podcast.
And now I've got some choice words. If only Brittany Griner had slapped Chris Rock, then maybe people would be saying her name. The near silence surrounding Griner's unjust detention in Russia has long seemed both sadly predictable and somewhat curious. It's sadly predictable that a sports world awash in NFL takes and that ignores women's sports would erase regular updates on Griner's existence as a political prisoner. Griner is a black queer woman in a league that receives reservoirs of disrespect. The sports world, as often has been said, would be in an uproar if this were Tom Brady. Well, they aren't, and it's damning. The curious part is why Griner's colleagues in the WNBA have mirrored that silence. WNBA legend Lisa Leslie went public with what a lot of us have heard behind the scenes. They have been instructed to keep quiet and exercise personal censorship for the sake of a broader political strategy aimed at securing her release and bringing her home. In an interview released about a week and a half ago, Leslie said, "What we were told, and again, this is all sort of passed along through hearsay, but what we were told was not to make a big fuss about it so that they could not use her as a pawn, so to speak, in this situation with the war. So to make it like it's not that important, or don't make it where we're like, free Britney, and we start this campaign, and then it becomes something that we can use," end quote. Let's be clear, this is a tactical strategy to not turn Griner into a cause celebre and instead let the expert negotiators do their job. It's also a tactical strategy that is not working. Here are some other factoids that we've learned recently about Griner's plight. Having been arrested in mid-February, she will not see a courtroom until May 18th. Once she enters what will be a kangaroo court, she will be facing a 10-year prison sentence, and a number of those years could be spent at a labor camp. A reminder that she was arrested right at the start of Russia's Ukraine invasion at a Moscow airport for the quote-unquote crime of having hashish oil in her luggage. One would have to be naive as a newborn to think she will get a fair trial, given the near total absence of diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Russia. That leads to yet another news nugget from the week that was. Confirmation that officials from the U.S. have finally, after weeks, been able to see Griner. The only comment received was, "Our official found Brittany Griner to be in good condition, and we will continue to do everything we can to see that she is treated fairly throughout this ordeal." Russian officials responded to this by saying that Griner has been available to be seen, but that the U.S. hasn't asked, something that beggars belief. Please take a step back from this situation because we are dealing right now with a series of bad choices. The State Department and whatever private attorneys or negotiators are involved have called for silence. No grassroots movement, no international uproar, no upsetting what they clearly see as a delicate situation. Their strategy has brought us to a point where Griner is facing years at a labor camp. The need to switch strategies and the need to let Russia and Putin know that the whole world is watching when Griner finally sees the inside of a courtroom May 18th has never felt more pressing. The time for silence has passed. Brittany Griner is a political prisoner and we need to treat her as such and bring the kind of spotlight and international solidarity that's so desperately needed. It's time to shame and name. We should be shaming the sports press for yapping it up about the NFL offseason 24/7 and pretend that Griner is not sharing a small cell with others in a bed too short for her 6'9" frame. We should be shaming the sports press and the political elites for their heteronormative discomfort in raising the name of a black queer woman with tattoos and a remarkably brave wife. And for those of us who have love for Griner and all she means on and off the court, we need to break the silence. Yes, it's time for the rallies, the hashtags, the petitions, and the press conferences. Does the State Department truly believe that raising up Griner's name will only make the situation worse? How much worse can it possibly get? By raising Griner's name up to the light, at least we have the hope of creating an untenable situation for Putin as he continues a war in search of an off-ramp. It's not just democracy that dies in darkness. Political prisoners quite literally die when their names are swallowed in our throats instead of shouted to the heavens. So free Brittany Griner, bring her home, stop the sports media blackout, and end the tactical silence. We'll be back right after this with a quick word from Edge of Sports. Hey everybody out there, this is Dave Zirin with the Edge of Sports podcast. People got to know that we put this podcast on with elbow grease and bubble gum on a weekly basis. And we're proud of the work that we do. We love it, but we can't do it without support from you, the listener. So please go to patreon.com/edgeofsportspod and support the podcast. That's patreon.com/edgeofsportspod. Any little bit you might give to support the podcast actually makes a huge difference to the work we're trying to do. That's patreon.com/edgeofsportspod. We appreciate you. Make no mistake about it. And now, back to the Edge of Sports podcast. Now it's time for the Just Stand Up Award. Just stand up and just sit your ass down. The Just Stand Up Award this week stand up! Goes to some brave souls over at the NCAA Women's Final Four. They are handing out buttons that say Free Brittany, and there are people rallying in front of the NCAA Women's Final Four saying Bring Brittany Griner home. Now, these are small actions, but the effort to try to invade a space where they are literally instructing people to not speak about Brittany Griner as part of a failing strategy to bring Brittany Griner home. Well, I'm just, you know, anybody breaking the silence. Because imagine for a second that you're Brittany Griner and imagine that we are able to get Brittany Griner back before she has to spend years in prison. And you're looking for people to thank. You're looking for people to thank for raising your name up when you were in the toughest situation of your life. Are you really going to thank people for being silent while you were in prison? Are you going to thank people for the bravery of doing nothing? I don't think so. I don't think so at all. So shout out to everybody trying to make sure Brittany Griner's name is part of the weekend at the NCAA Women's Final Four. And by the way, a lot of the media folks there, I can tell you this, are not being silent for Brittany Griner out of some respect for the family or for the State Department strategy. First of all, as if the State Department necessarily has their best interests at heart. But also, the silence comes from the fact that they want the NCAA Women's Final Four to be a media spectacle focused only on what's happening at the court for profit, to grow the sport, as they put it more delicately. And I mean, that to me is shameful. I mean, Brittany Griner is a former NCAA Final Four Most Outstanding Player, led an unbeaten Baylor team to the title. You know, this is simply wrong. And we need to actually, especially at the NCAA Women's Final Four, be raising up Brittany Griner's name. The Just Sit Your Ass Down Award.
Sit your ass down.
Sit Your Ass Down goes to Mike Krzyzewski, Coach K of Duke. I have no idea if he's going to beat UNC, if he's going to win the title, or if he's going to lose to UNC. Beat UNC, lose the title. I don't know what's going to happen. I'm recording this before the game, like just hours before the game on Saturday. I do know this. Mike Krzyzewski, don't let the door hit you on the way out. So done with Mike Krzyzewski. So done with, the PG-13 version of Bobby Knight that we've had to endure for so many decades. So done with him always finding fault with somebody else, particularly if they happen to be 18 or 19 years old and not taking the weight himself. Just so done. And if you want to know why, I've written about it a lot over the years. So just Google it on up. But done with Coach K. Mike Krzyzewski, retirement season, buddy. Sit your patootie down. Now it's time for the part of the show we call Kaepernick Watch, the latest comings and goings with Colin Kaepernick. Some serious Colin Kaepernick news this week. First of all, he has put out through the grapevine that he is willing to take a backup quarterback position in the NFL. That is a turn for Colin Kaepernick, who has been training six times a week for years in case he gets another shot at the league, but has said explicitly, look, I'm not coming back unless it's in a situation where I can start. Now he's saying he wants back in, and that, I think, further puts pressure on the NFL as they continue to sign the Nate Petermans of the world to contracts, that there should be a place for Colin Kaepernick in the league. The other Colin Kaepernick news is that he's going to be hosting a throwing exhibition with free agent NFL receivers at halftime of Michigan's spring game. The event is being sponsored by a Michigan student organization called Wolverines Against Racism. And it's great that there's an anti-racist student group. Apparently, from what I hear, Colin Kaepernick has already addressed the group in a private meeting. But even with all of that, you want to give the credit here to Jim Harbaugh, Colin's former coach over at San Francisco for the 49ers, and Harbaugh opening the doors up to Kaepernick. And I got to tell you, it's a savvy move by Harbaugh. This isn't a just stand up or just sit down situation. It's like Jim Harbaugh, who was critical of Kaepernick when he first took the knee, is now posing with him, smiling, giving him a custom-made jersey, having the players pose with him for photos. And these players are over the moon. It's like a rock star situation for them, because that's what Kaepernick means to this young generation of players. And if you think Jim Harbaugh is not going to use this relationship when he goes into a living room and is trying to convince a 6'6", 300-pound kid from rural Florida to not go to the SEC but instead travel to the cold environs of Michigan, then you don't know Jim Harbaugh. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Thank you so much, Cheryl Cookie. Thanks so much to the producer of this podcast, David Tigaboo. If you're out there listening, you got to mask up, please. I don't care what people are saying. Please, please, please stay frosty. Stay safe. We are out of here. Peace.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.